Accession number 20513, Reel 1.
Admiral Whetstone, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Coventry in 1927.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Coventry?
No, my father was a journalist, and when I was one, he moved up to the northeast coast, and we lived at a place called Whitley Bay.
So you regard Whitley Bay as your hometown?
No, I wouldn't regard it as my hometown. I was there from the age of one to the age of ten. And then my father moved back again to Coventry. So I did my secondary schooling all at Coventry.
Which school was that?
That was King Henry VIII School.
Was that a grammar school?
It was a direct grant grammar school.
How old were you when you left there?
I left there at the age of 17 to join the Royal Navy.
So you spent the Second World War years mainly in Coventry?
Mainly in Coventry, but after the big November Blitz, the school governors decided to evacuate the pupils, most of the pupils, to a little market town called Alston near Stratford-on-Avon. And I actually spent 2 years as an evacuee, but with the school totally evacuated there.
Were you in Coventry for the November attack?
I was in Nuneaton at the night of the November attack. I was in Coventry for the attacks in the following Easter time, because we were on school holiday.
Can you tell me what you remember about being in Coventry during the Second World War?
I can remember being... We had a shelter which we shared with our next-door neighbours in the garden. And I can remember night after night being in the shelter during the minor raids and listening. At one time, we were... The family had to move because some bombs landed in the field opposite us and failed to detonate. So we had to go and stay with friends for a night until they were put safe.
What was your address in Coventry during the war?
My address was 201 Broad Lane.
Were there many bombs in that area?
That was the only occasion when we got bombs very close to us, but the standard factory, which was used as a what they called a shadow factory, was only about a mile away, and there were one or two daylight raids on there.
Did you find it frightening during the bombing?
I regret to say I found it exciting. I think I was at that age when one never... The idea that one personally would be suffer from the result of the bombing tended not to enter into one's head, and the idea of being involved, however remote from this war, was I found quite exciting, I'm afraid.
What did Coventry look like?
Well, I mean, Coventry was... The centre was absolutely devastated. In the later raid, my school was completely burnt down. So Coventry was quite a small city before the war. And the raid hit us at a time when Britain's night defences were very rudimentary. And so the 500-odd sorties that the Germans flew were virtually unopposed.
At your age, was it possible to gather what adult morale was like?
I don't think one could. One tended to assume that most people were pretty resolute about it. All the people I had contact with, which were largely my father's friends in the what were originally air raid precautions and then became civil defence, seemed to take it as a job to be done. I don't think they were gung-ho, but they were certainly resolute.
What do you remember about the November raid when you were at Nuneaton?
Well, we can remember the sirens and the anti-aircraft guns and the drone of those distinctive German engines, which had a sort of synchronized beat, and the noise and the glow in the sky, as everybody said, oh, Coventry's getting it. And obviously my mother was with us, my father wasn't, he was on at his air raid post, and she, I think, at that time was concerned. And the next day we didn't go to school because people were advised not to try and travel. My mother went into Coventry and came back.
Did Nuneaton get any bombs?
Nuneaton was bombed later, but whether it was bombed because of diversionary decoy tactics or whether it was a deliberate raid, I think it's still undecided.
Can you tell me more about your evacuation to this place near Stratford-upon-Avon, please?
Yes, it was quite interesting because we were billeted on various families, and my brother and I were very lucky in that the people with whom we were billeted were extremely, extremely kind to us and became quite good friends with my mother and father. But for schoolwork, we shared some of the facilities of the local grammar school, but we also had our lessons in the town hall and in the Methodist church and various places. And it was almost from being a day boy, I became a sort of semi-boarding school boy, in that the school had a lot more, we all were very much closer together than we had been in Coventry.
What was the name of the place?
Alcester, A-L-C-E-S-T-R-E-R.
Was your education much affected by the move?
In retrospect, I think it must have been. At the time, one didn't question, one assumed this was just going on. We went to our lessons as we were told. It was what they used to call the school certificate, 2 years that we were evacuated. And one was not conscious of it. I think probably with a certain number of masters having been called up into the forces, in some ways we suffered from either inexperienced or very old teaching staff. But at the time one wasn't aware, but one of course was not in a position to make any comparisons.
Did you see much of armed forces round and about during the war?
Yes, we used to, sometimes on Sundays, we used to go out to a local airfield, which was, as I discovered later, a Bomber Command operational training unit, and watch the Wellington bombers doing circuits and bumps. And of course, there was always quite an amount of army movement, troops moving. Not too many exercises in that area, but moving to and fro through the area. And we saw the odd convoy coming through. And from end of 1941 onwards, of course, there was the occasional American.
How did troops behave from what you saw?
From what I could see, all right. I remember there were quite a few Czechoslovakian units in the area. They were great handsome brutes.
And why was it that you wanted to go in the Navy?
I don't know. When I'm asked this question, I sometimes say it was because I saw a war film, and people automatically assume it was In Which We Serve. But I say no, it was a film in which I showed a lot of infantrymen being told to get out of a trench. on the blast of a whistle. And I thought perhaps the Navy was a better way of serving one's country. And for some reason, which I find it very difficult to rationalize, I decided that I was going to be a professional sailor rather than merely opting for the Royal Navy when my time for call-up came.
Can you tell me about going into the Navy, first of all, please?
Yes, we went back to Coventry in 1942. The school completely reassembled. And I did my higher school certificates there. And I then had a bit of a contretemps with my headmaster, because like most schools, I think, of its type at that time, in the sixth form, one divided into the classicists, the modern studies, and the scientists. And my headmaster was very keen that I became a classicist, and I think he rather thought I might be one of the people who could have possibly gone to Oxford or Cambridge. But when I applied to join the Navy as a special entry cadet, as they were called, and I got the syllabus for the civil service examination, which one had to take, one had to offer both science and humanities subjects. So I decided that, whereas at English and French, with a certain amount of coaching, I could deal with this exam, my science was very weak. So I actually did my higher school certificate in science subjects. And since then, I've been a strong believer in the belief that one should not over-specialize in the sixth form. This is a side issue, but the civil service examination, which demanded a broader spectrum of achievement, I thought was not a bad idea.
So what was the next step?
The next step was being interviewed by an extremely awe-inspiring collection of admirals in London, being given my medical examination, which I thought was rather a joke because I did it with my leg broken and in plaster, having been playing rugby. And but they still passed me as fit for service. And I then went to the Royal Naval College, which at that time had been evacuated from Dartmouth to Eaton Hall in Cheshire. And we did three months at the Royal Naval College, followed by 3 months in the training cruiser.
What was it like at the Royal Naval College?
Well, the college, the building itself, the stately home of the Duke of Westminster, had been taken over by the cadets, the 13-year-old entry cadets. We special entry cadets, or pubs as we used to be called, because most of us were public school people, lived in Nissen huts in the grounds. And it was a Spartan and busy routine, and the discipline was strict, but it was by no means what you might call a savage routine at all. I mean, one didn't feel that people were deliberately going out of their way to be in any way cruel to you. But it was a Spartan regime, and, you know, getting up at 6:30 in the morning and having to go over in the... It was a very cold winter of 1945. And to walk 50 yards through the snow to an unheated bathroom to shave in the morning was a good shake-up for the thing. I think probably some of the people who came from the more Spartan public schools found it quite normal. Those of us who'd been cosseted at home found it initially a bit of a shock.
What was the course like?
The course?
Yes.
Oh, well, it was very basic. A certain amount of drill, a certain amount of naval law, seamanship, engineering, a bit of lectures about more professional subjects, but not very much at Eton Hall. A certain amount of boat work on the River Dee, followed by a number of exams and a passing out parade, which by modern standards was a very low-key affair.
And after Eton Hall?
After Eton Hall, we went up to Rosyth and joined HMS Frobisher, which after D-Day had been refitted to return to her pre-war role as the training cruiser. And we lived on board, slept in hammocks, did a mixture of instruction and honest sailor's work. And the ship used to go out with two other ships which carried what they called the upper yardmen, who were the ratings who had been selected for commissions. And we used to do joint exercises in the fourth. And then, of course, the E-Day occurred, and we were allowed to go further afield, and we used to go to various more isolated ports on the west coast of Scotland, Ullapool, Stornoway, Scapaflow, places. In the meantime, getting on with our instruction.
And then?
Then we came down to Portsmouth for our final passing out. I was then appointed as a midshipman and sent on leave, waiting passage to the Far East. The war in Europe having ended, the war in Japan. And but while I was waiting to sell my life dearly against the Japanese, the nuclear bombs were dropped. And so by the time I got out to Australia, the war in the Pacific had virtually ceased. And I joined a ship, the Duke of York, which was Admiral Fraser's flagship, which, of course, all the other people were had done their war and were looking forward to going home. It was an interesting time. We went to Singapore shortly after the Japanese war ended, and we were then sent to Hong Kong, where the war had ended so rapidly that we hadn't got any troops for an occupation force. And I was sent ashore, as indeed were quite a lot of our ship's company, to perform internal security duties.
In Hong Kong?
In Hong Kong.
What was that like?
Well, that was the thing that impresses me today is the resilience of the local population. It didn't seem by the time we got there, it was very much picking up. The shop selling all the curios, the teakwood chests, the camphor, the silver, the ivory, were all operating.
How did they seem to view the return of British power?
I think they were generally welcomed it. And of course, the mainland China was at that time in a complete state of turmoil, with the Chiang Kai-shek people still holding quite a large proportion of the country, especially the coastal strip, with the communists beginning their fight to control the whole of the country. And I think the Hong Kong people were more occupied with picking themselves up, and I think they accepted the fact that the British had come back, and there was no great desire, as far as I was aware, to do other than pick themselves up economically and socially.
So what did your internal security duties actually involve?
Well, it involved myself. I was put up with six sailors, two midshipmen and six sailors, and we were at what used to be the Peak Wilder station on the top of Victoria Peak. But it had been completely vandalized, and we merely were up there. We had a sentry on duty at the Wilder station. And very much a symbolic presence. There was some concern that there might be attempts to loot, but we hadn't anything really worth looting, so that didn't become a problem. And as time went on, we used to keep ourselves occupied in the afternoon by offering cups of tea to servicemen who'd made the trek up to the top of the peak to look at the view.
And then?
And then we turned over to a battalion of the Indian Army, the Jaipur Guards. And the first thing they did was dismantle the Western-type latrines which we'd constructed and replace them with their own sort of squatting sanitary arrangements. But they were all immensely tall, very strong, and obviously professional soldiers compared with sailors playing at soldiers. And we went back to the ship, and the Duke of York then sailed for Japan. And we went through the Inland Sea, and we visited Nagasaki and Tokyo. And it was while off Nagasaki, the American Army took us on a sort of tour of the devastation.
What was that like?
That was quite frightening. I mean, it was completely desolated and destroyed, apart from the odd framework of the odd building leaning over at an angle by the blast. And it impressed me considerably and affected me in later life when I was in positions of some authority. And during NATO exercises, people considerably younger than I would say during a paper exercise, "Isn't it about time we launched a few nuclear weapons?" And I would say, you know, "Do you realize what launching a few nuclear weapons involves?" And I was never a nuclear disarmer, except in the sense of total nuclear disarmament, which is, I think, rather like universal brotherhood, a pious hope rather than achievable reality. But I was very much in favor of a nuclear deterrent as a balance of mutual destruction, as being one way of preventing a war, rather than, as I think one or two later generations, certainly in America, have tended to think of it as just another step on the... I always considered it as a deterrent rather than a weapon, and I very much always took the view that as long as we didn't have to use it, this weapon was meeting its purpose. Once it was launched, it was an indication that the policy had failed.
Did you see any Japanese in Nagasaki?
In Nagasaki, no. We saw some in Tokyo. The Americans were already beginning to exercise their what you call re-indoctrination program. And Tokyo was starting to return, I wouldn't say return to normal, but become an ordered community again, but very much under American tutelage.
What was it like living and working in HMS Duke of York at this time?
Oh, Well, as a big ship of that time, except that I think that because a lot of our ship's company were hostilities-only ratings, and the war was over, there was possibly more emphasis on keeping the ship running and less on training. We used to do very occasional firings, practice firings of our weapons, and once or twice we did exercises with American units. But on the whole, it was maintaining our presence and keeping the ship running while a lot of the sailors were waiting for their demobilization time to turn up. We had a very good captain, Captain Nichols, who had been in command of HMS Penelope during the Malta convoys, who was a very fine man, and I think he saw his duty to keep this ship well ordered and run. And rather than continuing the preparations for the war, which was over. And I enjoyed my time there. I think I learnt a lot. The Navy was very different in those days, of course, in a lot of things. I mean, in the Duke of York, we had about 2,000 ships company. We probably had less radar equipped than the average yacht does today. One of the midshipmen's main duties was to run the ship's boats and you'd have a midshipman, a coxswain, a naval seaman and a stoker with the crew, and there were two crews for each boat working 24 hours about. And I think that was very valuable because it put one in a position of some authority over the sailors, gave you some experience of handling boats under all conditions, and sometimes it was quite exciting. For instance, bringing the Liberty men off from Hong Kong after a good run ashore, you'd have a rather raucous crowd of sailors singing, shouting, and generally showing that they were enjoying life and didn't want to go back on board. And at times one used to have to hang off the gangway, piping up in your adolescent voice that unless you chaps pipe down, I am not going to take this boat alongside the gangway. Go on, Middy, would be the cry. Eventually they calmed down. And you. Well, one night a chap almost fell in, and a great cry went up of don't forget his Burberry, which I thought was a good indication.
And then what happened after your visit to Japan?
Well, then we went back to Sydney, paid a brief visit to Tasmania, and came back, and we got back to Devonport in July 1946.
Did you meet Bruce Fraser?
Oh, yes. He wasn't on board all the time, but I met him, yes.
What was he like?
Very, very fine man. And he still maintained contact with one or two of us until he died. I met him, I forget the last time I met him, but it was some naval dinner many years afterwards. And he very tactfully, he seemed to remember me.
What did you do on return to England?
I was then appointed as, again as a midshipman, to HMS Implacable, which was the flying training carrier in the Firth of Forth, and it was where the Fleet Air Arm pilots used to complete their deck landing training.
What kind of duties did you have in that ship?
I was what they call the navigator's doggy, which I was mean the navigating officer's assistant. I used to make sure the charts were all in order for the trip, and generally assist him, make sure he was woken when he wanted to take his sights. And, of course, learnt quite a bit about the...